I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
I'm Jack Caparel, filling in for Andrew Schwartz. This week on The Trade Guys, we'll break down the debate over high technology exports to China. Plus, we'll predict what's likely out of President Trump's trip to India next week. And we'll take on the debate over whether developing countries should embrace protectionism to grow. Stay tuned for a brand new episode of The Trade Guys. All right, so we're back with a new episode of The Trade Guys, and let's start with a story that's kind of been bubbling up over the past month, but I think also throughout the entirety of the Trump administration, really, which is how the United States and the administration wants to deal with exports of high-tech products to China. And the debate really centers around what's known as export controls. And Bill, this is an area that you're deeply familiar with, so maybe you want to give us a little primer on what export controls are, why they matter, and why you know so much about such an archaic topic.
Well, it's past sins is the reason why I know about it. This is an interesting episode right now because it's exactly the same battle that they had 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and 30 years ago. The issues never really change. I thought when I was running the export control, civilian export control program in the 90s, in the Clinton administration, that we had solved some of these issues, but the same old battles are back. It's an interesting dilemma if you're in that business because there's a lot at stake. You know, you're trying to keep important stuff, critical technology, out of the hands of the bad guys. And what we've learned over the years is if your controls are too lax, the bad guys get stuff you don't want them to have. On the other hand, if your controls are too tight, other bad things happen. One, you give the bad guys an incentive to develop the same stuff on their own, which you don't particularly want. Second, as we're hearing right now, you undercut the revenue streams of your own technology companies by preventing them from selling stuff that allows them to be profitable. I'll get back to that in a minute. And the third thing you do is you make it difficult for the United States or U.S. companies to play a role in global standard setting. So when people sit down at the table internationally to create, for example, 5G standards, if the Americans are not allowed to provide information about what they're doing because Huawei is in the room, which is the issue, the result is most likely going to be a standard that accommodates Huawei and not a standard that accommodates U.S. companies. So there's a cost to being too tight. Just as so, there's a cost to being too loose. It's a fine line. What happened in the 90s, thanks largely to Bill Perry, who was first undersecretary and then secretary of defense, I thought who's my hero who really understood this stuff. He was, I think, one of the early people to realize the difficulty of trying to develop a defense establishment based entirely on stuff specially designed for the military. One of his assistants once told me, not joking, that one of their problems, particularly on software, was that the life cycle of what they were buying was shorter than the procurement process that they were using to buy it. So they were doomed. They were always behind the curve technologically. The answer that Perry realized was, let's go with commercial technology. Let's go to the big private companies and buy their stuff and use that.
And commercial off the shelf.
Commercial off the shelf.
Is a category COTS. Today. COTS is in the procurement laws.
But if you do that, it starts a logical chain that ends up turning export control philosophy on its head. Because if you think about that, what that means going to commercial off the shelf is that you become Cisco, HP, Intel, whoever's customer, if you're the Pentagon. But you're never going to be a very big customer for them compared to their civilian market. You're going to be, you know, less than 1% probably. So it's not a market you're going to be able to control. So then when you think about that from the defense standpoint, you think, what is it we really want? What we really want is American high-tech companies being strong, healthy, and innovating, staying ahead of everybody else so they can provide us with the stuff that we need. And by the way, so they can do classified work for us over on the side because they can afford to do that. And then you ask the next question, which is, so how do you do that? How do you make them strong and healthy? And when you look at their balance sheets, you realize that the way you make them strong and healthy is you let them export because it's more than half their revenue consistently. And once you get to that point, you've turned export control logic on its head because you realize that if the Pentagon is going to be able to get what it needs and get a vibrant critical technology sector in this country continuing to innovate, it has to let those people export because they have to make enough money to be able to continue to innovate. And that's what today's argument is about. The Commerce Department, you know, was considering essentially tightening up the controls on the export of semiconductors and some other things to China, specifically to Huawei. It wasn't broader than that. And the semiconductors came in and pointed out, you know, this is a lot of money for us. This is one of our best customers. The stuff you're letting us sell is not cutting edge. It's older technology. If you cut that off, you're going to take a significant chunk out of our revenue, and it's going to compromise our ability to move forward. And because of the way the uncertainty of what you're doing, it makes it difficult for us to go to these international standard setting meetings and know what we're allowed to say and what we're not allowed to say.
Well, this is the consequence of actually what Secretary Paulson said at CSIS almost exactly a year ago. We had a trade conference here. Secretary Paulson was the speaker, and he characterized the pivotal issue in U.S.-China trade policy will be the technology Cold War. And we're seeing it in full flower here.
And to make it more complicated, for a long time, the U.S. policy, which I think was I had a small hand in it, but I think it was brilliant, which was not to deny the bad guys everything. I mean, the sanctioned countries, North Korea, sure, but not to deny China everything, but to keep them one or two generations behind us. That did two things. It made sure they were behind, but it also kept them dependent on our products.
They didn't create the business
on their own. They didn't need to go off and do it on their own. That worked very well for about 30 years. You can make the case now, and this is going on inside the government, you can make the case that policy's run out of gas because the Chinese have made the decision for autarky. They've made the decision that they're going to develop their own technologies, their own national standards, and they've got the money to do it. And they've got the scientists and engineers to do it. So in that case, maybe the policy we've been pursuing very successfully doesn't work. On the other hand, the people that want to crack down are only going to compromise our ability to further innovate and further compromise. This was heading for a very odd battle in the government because the Commerce Department wanted to crack down and the Defense Department didn't because the Defense Department was listening to its suppliers and its suppliers were coming in saying, if you do this, it's going to make it much more difficult for us to meet your needs. This is the reverse of what usually happens. It's usually the Commerce Department that wants to loosen things up. Until this week, it looked like the hawks, if you will, were going to win. And then the president produces a tweet.
Right.
That says, wait a minute, we want to sell stuff to China.
He said they're using, quote, a fake term of national security to justify restrictions. Quote, I think people are getting carried away with it. I mean, there are things put on my desk that have nothing to do with national security, including chip makers and various others. So we're going to give it up. And what will happen? They'll make those chips in a different country or they'll make them in China or someplace else. And so, I mean, I understand the logic from the president. Surprisingly enough.
It pains me to admit that he did something right.
I want to add two questions to this on the back of what the president said, which is, you know, one, why was he forced to weigh in this debate in such a manner? I mean, why has it gotten so complicated to kind of hash out our relationship with China, particularly when it comes to high tech items? And then second, is there not some sort of middle ground? I mean, it seems like the issue is being portrayed in a pretty black and white way here. Either we sell them the chips or we don't sell them the chips, or we sell them the jet engine or we don't sell them the jet engine. But what's the middle ground? Or is there one, particularly because we're dealing with a rival that some would call?
Well, it's still the middle ground, I think, is still what we've been doing, which is to sell them the old stuff not the newest stuff.
That may well work in many product categories. You know, jet engines. You know, for instance, you can reverse engineer jet engines, but why would you? And selling jet engines, whether they're Boeing or whether GE or Pratt & Whitney or whoever's making them, you can use the old processes, as Bill described, to protect your technology and not create a rival. But that doesn't necessarily apply to everything. And I think the big concern, overwhelming concern right now, is the network technology, where there's not a United States consolidator like Huawei. There are a lot of U.S. suppliers to Huawei and others. But it's a commitment because it's a commitment to the backbone of the network. It has greater security implications at large. So I'm not sure there's a one size fit all here.
I agree with Scott, and I think the president got into it precisely because of the example he cited, the engines. And there are ironies there. We had that same debate about the same engines, an earlier model, 30 years ago. People didn't want to sell them to China, planes going to China then. They don't seem to want to do it now. I think the president figured out this is technology that it's been 30 years. Maybe they've reversed engineering, but they're not making their own engine. You know, they're still buying GE or Rolls-Royce engines. This is an important market. It's important for GE. They're going into civilian aircraft. So it's not exactly we're selling them weapons, you know. And I think the president realized that, particularly if your focus is on reducing the deficit, which his is, these things are a significant, you know, part of our trade balance.
Sure. And the president just got a little bit of good news a week or two ago on the trade deficit, which had shrunk, much to many's surprise, a little bit, but enough to take credit for it. And I think he'd like to continue that just as a way to help the narrative between now and the election.
He probably tweeted because he saw something on television and it caught his fancy. But the reality is this would have come to him eventually. This is an issue that people have been divided on for a long time, and the agency players had unusual positions. I mean, defense and commerce were sort of reversed, but the bottom line is still the same. There was division between his advisors over what to do. It's natural for that to come up to the top, so I think it would have gotten there sooner or later.
So let me just put my China hawk hat on really quick. If you view China as a national security threat, right, they have a wholly different economic and political system that is at odds with the United States. Mm-hmm. We just fought are still fighting a huge trade war with them. And their chief security concern, voiced by our defense officials, I mean, why should we be selling them anything that approaches sensitive technology to begin with, right? Why can't we just say, go build your own jet engines and, you know, we think Huawei is a national security threat, so you can't have our chips and good luck.
Because it compromises our ability to innovate. There are classic cases of this too. The example that I used a lot when I was doing this in the government was a night vision equipment, you know, the goggles you use to see people at night. And the Pentagon wanted the United States Army to have them.
And they didn't want nobody else.
No, and nobody else.
Right.
Small market.
Right.
If you think about the marketing of this, though, I mean, this is a capitalist economy. People that make these things want to grow. And I think somebody figured out that once everybody in the Army has one, that's it.
Yes.
You know, if you can't sell them to anybody else until you make the next model, and then you do it again. So they did what good capitalists do everywhere. They thought of civilian uses for these items.
Hunters.
Miners.
And miners.
Miners, night fishing.
Night fishing.
Firemen.
Sure.
Firemen was a big one because you go into smoke-filled rooms. If you want to see the bodies, use these
things. You can actually find them with night vision. Yeah.
Lovely.
And the Pentagon still tried to block. I mean, one of the oddest cases, as I recall, was we wanted to sell them. Somebody wanted to sell them to the Spanish Army. And the Pentagon's position was, no, you can't do that. We pointed out they're a NATO ally. You know, but apparently that didn't matter. The consequence of that now is that there are three or four other countries that make these things.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a lock on all these technologies. I've said this before on this podcast, and I say it in my speeches. When you're having a race, you either trip the other guy, or you run faster. The answer to your question of what do we do is we run faster. We stay a generation or two ahead of them. Now, part of that is what do we do to run faster? And one thing we do to run faster is make sure that our companies have enough money to do it.
Right. The same thing, basically, the story repeated itself in unmanned aerial devices, drones.
Sure.
Okay. Where one of the leading centers of innovation is now Israel.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And they make them for the commercial market and all sorts of things. So there's innovation. There's a lot of innovation that goes on outside the United States and outside the United States government. And that's what you've got to protect. You got to protect the innovation pathway as you think carefully about who you sell what to.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
We used to have this argument endlessly because people on the defense side would say, our technology is better than everybody else's. And all the other stuff that's going to get invented is inferior. So we should keep ours. Don't let anybody else have it. And we'll be better off. That's just nonsense. It turned out not to be true. Other people are capable of having good ideas and coming up and developing and inventing stuff that works. And so, you know, the key is out innovating them, not simply trying to, you know, in a way it's the same issue as you know, a protectionist trade theory.
You right.
know, if you wall your country off from trade, it slows down basically. and other people move faster and go beyond. And that's what's happening here. The problem is that if you're not careful, you do end up selling them stuff that will enhance their military capabilities,
right,
which you don't want to do.
Right.
Bill mentioned protection, so it's a good time to talk about India.
Yes. That's the other country in the news alongside China. The president is heading there early next week to meet with Prime Minister Modi, and one item that's been rumored to be on the agenda is some sort of mini trade agreement. But it seems like we talk about some trade outcome with India every six
Can
months.
Can we start a pool on whether they'll actually sign anything or not?
Yeah, I mean, I would put my money on
somewhere between not now or not and not ever.
Yeah, I want the under on that one, whatever the over under is.
Yeah, so we're all betting on the same thing. We're all pessimistic, and I guess the question is why. I mean, we do this dance every 6 months. What are they going to agree to? It's the same kind of gripes. It's the same concerns. So why do we keep going in circles?
Well, look, India is a multi-party democracy. And they operate that way. They also have a sense of the world that is first and foremost about India. They think of themselves as sufficient in many ways. They're becoming more prosperous in a lot of ways, but there are a lot of old habits that they are not all that unhappy with.
Like what?
Well, like what they call the permit rush and the very bureaucratic way of getting anything done. All right. Americans go to India and see the buildings are only five stories tall because there's not enough reliable electric power to be able to count on an elevator. And they think this is a problem, but the Indians don't think it's a problem. So there's a lot of things that go on in their society, which they're happy with. But keep in mind, it's also a multi-party democracy and of a billion plus people.
Mm-hmm.
And so to succeed at anything, you've got to put together roughly 300 to 400 million votes, which is not an easy task. So there's I think a fair amount of resistance. We'd call it resistance to change, but I don't get the sense India thinks it needs to change all that much.
Right.
The other example that's been fought out lately without result is the retail issue. It's mm-hmm. a country of small shopkeepers.
Right.
And the big boxes and Walmart being a good example has made a concerted attempt over the years to get in there and build what they do in the United States. And there's been ferocious political resistance from all the small guys who are afraid that they're going to get put – not without entirely without reason – that they're going to get put out of business. But that's where the political power is.
India is a huge market, obviously. Do you expect that the president will set his target on India the same way he kind of put China in the crosshairs a while back? Or do you think that the dynamic is different? So India comes out of this unscathed, even if there isn't some sort of, you know, trade agreement that the president can go tout?
I'm expecting a completely different picture than China. China was characterized as the problem, as inconsistent with, you know, sort of everything we valued, and an unfair trader, okay? The relationship with India is very different. First of all, there's not much of a trade relationship, partly because of distance, partly because of India's own practices. Second, there has been an embrace by India and the Indian American community of the president. I mean, go back and watch some of the rally that took place in Houston, Texas.
Yeah, Howdy Modi.
Yes, right. It was pretty impressive. And I think the president is about to find himself in even larger, more adoring crowds when he gets to India.
There are supposed to be millions of people at the airport.
Yes, and that's a fascinating dynamic, but it's a political dynamic entirely unlike U.S.-China politics. Okay, which have been tense for a long time and for all the reasons we've discussed before. So I think it's a very different situation. Also, I don't think the president needs much in this election year in terms of deliverables, but he would like a favorable reception. And I think the president was in the travel services business before he became president. And he knows that while China has five times as many millennials as the United States, India has six times as many millennials. And it's going to be a huge consumer market. And believe it or not, Indian millennials want the same thing that American millennials do. They want experiences. They want travel. They want new adventures. And so as a market, not necessarily for stuff, for cars and steel and things the president talks about at home, but for the things the American economy is a leading producer of at all ends of the market, I think he senses the opportunity there and a way to sort of make peace and advance things with a country that is likely to be sort of a better friend than China ever could.
Yeah.
We're also in a situation where the Indians want something from us. The president remove them from our generalized system of preferences program, which is the duty-free program we have for developing countries. And they badly want to get back into it. It's hundreds of millions of dollars of potential trade that's been lost.
Most of their exports to the U.S. have been covered by GSP.
So they've gone from duty-free to having to face a lot less tariffs. Yep.
And I think what Ambassador Lighthizer is saying, if you want to get that back, you have to make trade concessions that are equivalent. And they've been searching for products that are not so politically sensitive that the Indians can do it. They've also been looking – this is I thought was creative. They've been looking for products where India has right now been buying them from China, where they could buy them from the United States. And from the United States' point of view, that serves two purposes.
That's a win-win, yeah.
Yeah, that's win-win if they can alter the source of that stuff. The signs last week when Ambassador Lighthizer ended up not going to India despite predictions that he would is that this is not yet ready for signature.
It's not ripe.
So ultimate prediction out of the trip next week, no deal, small deal, or big deal?
Promise of a magnificent, luxurious deal.
Okay. So that's par for the course.
Yeah, but no substance.
And probably after the election is what the promise will be because like China phase two, I think the president would love it before the election. I don't think that he's going to get it.
Nor does he need it in many ways.
Well, I don't think I agree with you on that. I think he thinks he needs it.
Oh, okay. Fair point because he's making a trip.
He wants to have all the agreements that he can to brag about. But what is guaranteed is that if he's not going to get one, he's going to pull the plug preemptively and say, we're going to do this after the election.
Right.
Yeah.
He's not going to fail before the election.
He's already kind of previewed that saying, this might take some time, so stay tuned.
Which is a sign that it's not likely to happen, and this is going to drag on for a while.
So we have a listener question that maybe takes us from the specific to the theoretical on this issue. It's from Henrique Mota. Apologies if I've mispronounced your name. He says, hi, I've been reading Ha Ju Chang's book, Kicking Away the Ladder, where he explains how nowadays developed countries got to this level using protectionist tariffs and heavy state involvement. Do you think that in a modern economy this would be possible since everything is more connected?
It's actually a great question because it is the question about how has the world really changed in the last 25 years. 25 years ago, the most popular theory of development economics was something called import substitution industrialization, or ISI. Import substitution industrialization was a recognition that if you weren't industrialized, you had to do something to get there. You couldn't just catch up on your own. And so the theory was that you lowered barriers for parts and components, you raised the tariff barriers on finished goods, and you then created the incentives for producers to produce in your market. It was practiced in many places. South Africa still does to some extent. All their autos basically are assembled in South Africa. Otherwise, they face a prohibitive tariff. Brazil has long practiced this. India practices it in certain sectors. Okay, so it was a very popular theory. What caused the theory to fail, though, was the globalization 2.0, which we've talked about here, is cheap data and the ability to control precisely all these tasks at a distance. And really, so since the mid-90s, The better economic strategy for a country that is not an industrial economy is to become part of some other industrial economy's supply chain rather than force the localization through import substitution. There's actually a great test case of this in automobiles in the ASEAN, and it is Malaysia and Thailand.
Interesting.
Okay. So it's a textbook study of this because Malaysia for a long time, even back to the 1970s, had put a great premium on having their own car company.
Proton
was the brand name. Yes, is the brand name. They wanted their own national automobile, like every other nation as they saw it. And they went to great lengths to create the Proton. Okay, they maintained it. They started it in the 1980s with a partnership with, I believe, Mitsubishi, and they sourced basically Mitsubishi's old technology and built the car locally, as any good import substitutor would. Now, Thailand never had any of those kind of ambitions, but when Japan and Japanese nameplate automakers were looking to build supply networks, Thailand created policies that made them a really terrific supplier to all the Japanese nameplate automobiles. Now, the long story of Malaysia is that they failed miserably to produce a competitive automobile. Protons are like You know, think of the Yugo, okay, and or some other classic examples.
Trabant, of
Hungarian engineering or something like that. You know, it was never a good car, never a car that actually could be sold in any market outside of Malaysia. And they struggled along for a while. They kept using old technologies. They tried everything, okay? They bought technology. They bought Lotus, the British company, which was an engineering company. They bought a Spanish company, MB Agusta, and nothing could make that car competitive because they were always behind in technology. Meanwhile, Thailand, very cooperatively, winds up with something like three times the automobile employment as Malaysia.
Organically.
Well, by lowering barriers and becoming part of the Japanese nameplate automakers' supply chains. So what you had was import substitution was not a terrible alternative back before global value chains. In the world of global value chains, participating in somebody else's chain is much more probable that it would lead to success. And the classic case study was you wound up with something like three or four times the auto workers in Thailand, which never had a national champion. And the poor national champion, Malaysian company, now owned by China, by the way, Geely of China, bought the Proton. So I wish them all the luck in the world. But that's the story.
Surprising.
So basically, to answer the listener's question, which is a great one, you can do this. You can follow import substitution. To do so, you have to force your citizens to pay more for poorer products. That's the tax that is imposed by that, okay? If you ever go to India, look at a Royal Enfield motorcycle. And it's a 1960s British motorcycle, just as lousy as they were in Britain in the 1960s, still made in India. You'll never find a Honda, though, because the barriers keep the Hondas out, despite much globally competitive product, probably at a lower price.
Well, philosophically, this was a big thing in Latin America in the 50s and 60s. And I mean, the other thing that happened was it, for the most part, didn't succeed.
Right.
I mean, they pursued import substitution policies. It simply did not produce the growth that they wanted.
And in a world of value chains, you can wind up by bad policy being on the outside looking in. I mean, once you've decided to have these barriers in place, the incumbents who benefit from the barriers will want to keep them there. And you have to liberalize to become part of value chains. Now, sometimes you're just too far. South Africa's problem is it was just too far from any other markets to be able to join a value chain realistically. But it does keep you on the outside of the way jobs get created today. So it's an important lesson that policy may be forever, but technology changes all the time.
Fantastic answer. If our listeners have questions, you can find our email question box at tradeguys.csis.org. I think with that, we'll wrap it up and be back next week with a brand new episode.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it.
We're also now on Spotify, so you can find us there when you're listening to the Rolling Stones or you're listening to Tom Petty or whatever you're listening to. Thank you, Trade Guys.
Thanks, Andrew.
You've been listening to The Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.